This is Audible.
Penguin Audiobooks presents The Deep End of the Ocean by Jacqueline Michard. Read by Dana Ivey.
Altogether, it was 10 years, easily 10, from the hot August morning when Beth put the envelope full of pictures into the drawer, until the cold fall afternoon when she took them out and laid them one by one on her desk. 10 years and change, actually. The previous summer had marked a full year since Beth had learned what happened to her son Ben. And if she counted the whole spiraling spectacle of what came after, it was really closer to 11. She stared at the driveway picture, wishing she had her good photographer's loop. There was Jill, Pat's college-age cousin, who lived with them then and helped out while she went to school, carrying Beth's cameras and bags. Jill with long hair, looking like a sunny little hippie. There was Carrie, 6 months old, a minuscule infant face above a dress bordered with red and blue and yellow boats. Vincent had still been blonde. Beth couldn't remember her older son with his brown mat, lush and coarse as bear fur, ever having been blonde. But Ben's face, that was a blur. Poised to receive that face like sacrament from the drawer bottom, she saw instead not much of anything. She saw details. How very many freckles he'd had on his arms. How long and enormously well-muscled his legs were, even then. But his face was blurred. You could tell his mouth was open. He'd been talking. But his features were indistinct. There was no message, no trace of the hint she'd expected. Even changed as she was on the molecular level, all her old beliefs discarded, she had still somehow expected it. Beth had been a newspaper photographer and photo editor for more than 10 years, so she'd seen many photos of people who later came to trouble. Soldiers in fresh uniforms with raw shaves, immigrant families at the metal rails of ships in layers of clothes, their luggage beside them on the deck. Cowboys, aviators. In those muddy images, she thought sometimes that she saw a hint, a foreknowledge of the mishap to come. The clue, she fancied, was the look in people's faces. A vulnerability? A message of departure in the photo grain? Beth had once put stock in such things. She had a whole history, a life structure set up on luck, dreams, and hunches. And it all went down like dominoes in a gust on the day Ben disappeared. All Beth's forebodings about the picture were simply the result of letting one thought based so long, it seemed true simply by virtue of having lasted. Like the immigrants, the aviators, and the cowboys, like all those pilgrims. The two women and three children on the suburban porch, framed by a bower of rather faded lilacs, had no idea of the destiny toward which they were pointed. There had been no warning. There never was any, at all.
"I only like the baby," Beth sighed as she and her husband stacked plastic bags and diaper bags and duffel bags and camera bags and Beth's big old backfold reflector all in a pile in the hall. She was surprised when Pat looked at her with disgust. She knew he didn't want to fight, didn't want to make trouble on the verge of clearing the whole tribe out for a weekend. It was foolish in the extreme, according to Pat, her plan to take all the children to Chicago, attend her 15th high school reunion, and shoot a job. Vincent wanted to go to the restaurant with Daddy. He told Beth so this morning 8 times.
You cannot go to the restaurant with Daddy, she finally snapped at him, wondering if she would actually lay hands on him if she heard his wheedling voice just one more time. Daddy will be working.
I can sit quiet in the back, Mom. I did it that one time.
It had been the peak experience of Vincent's life thus far, going to spend a Saturday night with Pat at the restaurant he managed for his Uncle Augie.
Vincent, we plan to go all together to Chicago, and you'll see Aunt Ellen, and I need you to help me watch Ben and Carrie.
But, Mom, I hate Ben and Carrie, and I hate that I have to do everything, and I'm not even going to get dressed.
Vincent wasn't forgiving. Ben was. He was delighted to be going out of town with his mother and his brother that morning, as delighted as he would have been to go to the hardware store or sort mixed socks. Ben wasn't just accommodating. He simply expanded with great good humor and faith to fill any space you put him in. But even his charm was wearing thin today. Ben had taken all the medicine and makeup out of Beth's bags and lined the bottles up like toy soldiers against the door. She stepped on a bottle, cracking it, and vitamins exploded everywhere.
God damn it! She stumbled.
And when Pat arrived, gracefully, to help her, she told him the momentary truth. She liked only Carrie, who was unformed, dependent in simple ways, and couldn't even sit up. Pat picked up a medicine bottle.
Just get on the road, Beth. They'll settle down. They'll go to sleep.
So she and Pat dragged everything out to the Volvo and strapped Carrie and Ben into their car seats and got Vincent and Ben out again to make sure they went pee and had their toothbrushes, when Pat suddenly remembered he wanted to finish the roll of film from their camping trip. They stood in the bower the lilacs formed. Pat snapped. Beth leaped into the driver's seat. She didn't kiss him. She'd see him in 2 days anyway. In fact, she'd see Pat before the sun went down, Beth later recalled. The drive down Route 90 to Chicago was never a pleasure. She and Pat used to have some petting fun in their old Chevy Malibu years before, coming home from college for Christmas, to families who were speechless with delight that the two of them were in love. These days, it was simply what it was, a stupid, boring, flat farms and then suburban sprawl shot for 150 miles. They made the trip often because all the members of both their families lived in the Chicago area. Pat and Beth had belonged to each other from junior year at the University of Wisconsin, and even in a sense before, as the children of parents who didn't consider it a holiday unless they played poker together. Pat and Beth had played with each other at picnics or in friendship emergencies. They went to each other's first communions, to each other's high school graduation parties. But they never really saw each other as gendered, until the day they ran into one another on the Library Mall in Madison, 3 hours before they fell into bed at Pat's attic dump and missed the next 2 days of classes. He wasn't handsome, not even when he was young. He had a wide, white smile and straight teeth. Perfect collusion, he called it. But he was short and slight, with unruly curly brown hair and face-saving huge eyes. His shoulders were broad, but his legs were skinny, almost bowed. Pat looked waifish, starving, and was so uncomfortable around people, so eager to please them, that they believed he was the friendliest guy they ever met. But it had been she, not Pat, who had gotten up from the hard bed more than a dozen years ago, certain they'd marry. She knew at last she was safe. Beth hadn't asked Pat to the dance and dinner that would form the centerpiece of her reunion. He knew plenty of her old Immaculata crowd. He'd been 2 classes ahead of her at the same school. He would have been welcoming to her friends. Pat was, Beth believed, probably among the most entirely cordial people in America. But he would have found the jokes stiff, the friendliness forced, the opportunities for telling old stories and dishing old enemies meaningless and cruel. Beth, on the other hand, couldn't wait. She thought about tonight, all the people from the neighborhood she'd see, who'd all be more wealthy than she, but not so creative, nor so good-looking, and certainly not possessed of so many lovely children.
Good-looking, thought Beth. I'm good-looking. Not pretty,
but objectively speaking, a solid 7 on the scale. When Beth thought about her own appearance, the word that came to her mind was square. She had square shoulders, across to her until they became fashionable, and a square chin. Even Beth's hair, when she let it hang of its own considerable weight, was square. And so, to her continuous despair, were her hips. Beth's own looks could never hold a candle to Ellen's, though Ellen, her childhood best friend, had spent 20 years telling Beth, "No one ever looks at your butt, Bethy. They never get past the bewitching green eyes." Ah, Ellen. From Beth's point of view, the whole point of this reunion weekend was Ellen. Ellen was waiting for her at the hotel. Ellen, who lived in the same West Side neighborhood where all of them had grown up, a street over from the house Beth's father still owned. Ellen had booked a room for the two of them, and a room for Jill and all the kids. She left her husband, her son, and a thawed tuna casserole up at her northern suburban mini-mansion, and bought a fancy black rayon dress. She'd sent Beth a drawing of it in the mail. The prospect of the weekend had reduced both of them to 17. "I think if Nick asks us to sit with them, we should," Ellen wrote on the bottom of the drawing. "His wife won't mind. After all, you fixed them up." Beth's first love, the most beautiful boy she'd ever seen before or since, the memory of whom could still make her abdomen contract, often ran into Ellen and her brothers, and occasionally worked with Ellen's husband on development contracts. Beth hadn't seen Nick for 10 years. She'd wondered then, as she often did, if she should have married him. Beth herself had introduced Tricia and Nick at the Feast of Our Lady of Mount Carmel, when they were both 21. After an hour, there was no turning back. When Tricia married Nick, Beth stood up in the wedding, got drunk, and threw up on her beige organdy dress. She wouldn't throw up any more, but Beth wanted to get drunk with Ellen, get drunk and giggle and whisper and rush to the bathroom as if they had important things to conference about in there. She wanted to forget until Sunday that she had children and a cesarean. By the time Beth had eased the wagon under the portico of the Tremont Hotel on School Drive, Ellen was on her, tugging her shoulder, trilling, "You're here! You're here!" "I don't even know if they still have my reservation." "They do, Beth. I stuck it on my card." Beth was horrified. "Ellen, you can't do that." Ellen had money. Everybody in construction was loaded, as far as Beth could tell. And though it was Pat's dream to someday own part of the restaurant, and Beth's to someday own her own business, they were lean now. They'd been lean as long as they could remember. Ellen paid at restaurants when they ate together. She sent Carrie savings bonds as if the country were at war. But there were times Beth balked. "You can't pay for me, Ellen." Ellen shrugged. "You're going to have to go up there in that mess and arrange it then." They straggled into the lobby. It was jammed. Virtually all the out-of-towners who'd come back for the reunion were registered there. Beth almost gave up. Ellen leaned toward Beth conspiratorially. "I saw Cecil Lockhart. She looks just like Gloria Swanson now. She has white hair. On purpose." The antique flicker of annoyance Beth still felt at the mention of Cecil Lockhart's name took her by surprise. She realized that she'd been hoping that Cecil, the swan-like, gray-eyed girl who grew up next door to Ellen, would skip this occasion. Cecil, whose real name was Cecilia, was, Beth judged, the only of the Immaculata graduates from her year to have made more of herself as a creative soul than Beth had. And it rankled. Cecil taught acting at the Guthrie in Minneapolis. She was very much married. Cecil was, Ellen told Beth now, still a size 6 with a belt. Ellen knew. She'd seen Cecil last year at an arts ball. Cecil had had the distinction of being the first of them to ever have sexual intercourse at 16. She'd liked it. She couldn't imagine, she told Beth one October night, ever not doing it. When Beth spun around to grab the luggage trolley, she stumbled into Nick Palladino's chest. "Beth, where'd you get all those kids?" Nick smiled. Beth's stomach bubbled. "Just made them up with things we already had around the house." She and Nick hugged. Tricia hugged her. Nick and Tricia were wearing white cotton suits that would have looked ridiculous on anyone else, On them, the suits looked like a spread in Town and Country. Beth smiled madly and concentrated on working her way to the front of the check-in line. She motioned toward the luggage trolley. "Jill, push this thing over by the elevator." She handed the baby to Ellen and lifted Vincent onto the trolley. "Vincent, I want you to hold Ben's hand real tight. You can look around and you can stand on this funny cart, but hold his hand while Mama pays the lady, and then you can go swimming." Vincent gripped Ben's hand limply. Beth touched Vincent's shoulder. "This will only take a minute now, see? Jill is getting the bags. You just stand here." Nick had drifted away. She could see Ellen, a sherbet-colored crown above the other women's heads, surrounded by men, making Carrie's hand wave bye-bye up and down. Beth pushed through the backs in front of her. It probably took 5 minutes, even though the counter girl was slower than weight loss, and even though Beth gave her a gas card by mistake first, and the girl ran it without realizing it wasn't a Visa. Absolutely not 10 minutes, Beth would tell the police later, even though Beth ran into a cousin of Pat's and her old lab partner, Jimmy Doherty, now a cop in Parkside. 10 minutes at the outside, no more. At last, clutching a sheaf of carbons, her wallet, and Carrie's pacifier, Beth made her way back to the elevator. Vincent was standing slumped against the wall, slowly pushing the trolley back and forth with his feet. "Vincent, where's Ben?" Vincent shrugged expressively. "He wouldn't let me hold him. He wanted Aunt Ellen." Beth scanned the lobby for Ellen. There she was, easy to see. Beth whistled. Ellen plowed toward her, Carrie in her arms. "Ellen, do you have Ben? He took off. We have to find him before we do anything." Ellen rolled her eyes and headed for the newsstand. There were toys on spinning racks there. Baby bait. She went outside and scanned the sunny street in both directions, then came back in, circled the elevator, and darted into the deserted coffee shop. Beth ran back to the elevator. "Vincent, think hard. Which way did Ben go?"
"I don't know, Mom. Didn't you watch?"
"I couldn't see him, Mom." Ellen came slowly through the crowd, pulling Beth to her with a look. "He wasn't over there, Beth." Beth frowned. "Ellie." Ellen charged across the room and leapt onto the luggage trolley. She was 5'10", and even before she yelled, "Stop," a score of old classmates had turned to look at her. But when she did yell, talk ceased in the lobby as if a light switch had been flicked off. Ellen scanned the lobby. "We all need to look for Beth Carey's little boy. He's 3. His name is Ben, and he was here a minute ago. He's got to be in the room, so divide up, look all around where you are, and if you find him, pick him up and stand still." And they all did that. They set down their bags where they were, and the whole room burst forth like a choir. "Ben! Ben!" in a shower of different timbres of voice. Beth's the loudest. Jimmy Doherty cut the room in halves by walking through and assigned people quadrants. Nick took off at a lope down the first-floor corridor. 20 minutes later, a few small groups of newcomers were greeting one another again, but most of the faces nearest Beth watched her for direction, in their eyes a kind of embarrassed pity. Ben was gone. It was Jimmy who said they might as well call the police. Not that the kiddo wasn't somewhere right nearby anyhow, but it would move things along quicker, you know? Jimmy knew everybody at Parkside. In fact, if not for the reunion, he'd be working today. He took Beth's hand. "Bethy, you'll feel better. He's probably asleep in a linen closet." The manager, a chubby, fancy man, was waving his hands with large gestures intended to play across the room. He berated the counter slut, checked the doors to the swimming pool to make sure they were locked, and summoned security, which turned out to be 2 hefty older men in ill-fitting purple livery. Beth sat on the luggage trolley, skinning her hair back from her face with her hands. Her legs were gelatinous. She couldn't stand. Vincent was curled behind her, holding Ben's blanket, asleep. Jill had taken Carrie upstairs and put her down on a bed. After the first fruitless search, the lobby had drained of alumni. Beth watched people slink away, talking low, not quite sure what they dared do. It was 5 minutes to 2, Ben had been missing now for one full hour. Unless Beth was working or giving birth, Ben had never been out of Beth's sight for one full hour in the 3 years of his life. So, this was serious. The lobby filled with handsome young policemen. Almost all short, Irish, Italian, a couple of black guys, one tan Nordic. A woman with long brown hair in a bun, looking awkward in a uniform clearly not styled to fit the contours of her body. She came over and sat down beside Beth on the trolley.
Scared, huh? Don't worry, we'll find him. I mean, I've been a cop for 5 years, and I've looked for a dozen kids, and we always find them.
She stopped and looked at Beth.
We find them, and they're okay, not hurt.
The manager was florid now as he walked toward Beth, and smelled thickly of cigarette smoke.
Would you like something to eat?
Beth considered. She didn't see how it would be possible to eat.
I'd like a vodka and tonic.
The manager's mouth formed an O in surprise, but he bustled off, literally snapping his fingers to the bartender. The brown-haired police officer with the artful bun tapped her clipboard.
Paperwork. I have to ask you a couple of things, Mrs. Capodora.
Beth sighed. Yes. What?
He's three, your son?
Beth nodded. Just turned.
And he has what, brown hair?
He has red hair. He has dark red hair, auburn, and a red baseball cap. He's wearing an orange shirt with red fish on it, and navy blue shorts, and red high-top gym shoes. Those are new. Parrots.
Beth hunkered down and talked. In detail, she described Ben's birthmark, the ashy-colored inverted V that sat just above his left hip. Sensing the officer's restlessness, Beth next talked about Vincent, who had awakened, gone off with Ellen to get a sandwich. He was a difficult kid, but he loved Ben and was protective of Ben.
Beth looked at the cop.
Carrie's named after me. I mean, not Beth, but that's my last name, Carrie, before I got married. Ben's named after my brother.
The lobby was filling up again with police officers Beth hadn't seen before. As Beth watched, two of them set up a folding table in a small room off the lobby that was probably used to hold coats, with a number of cellular phones and a compact radio that squawked and crackled. She turned to the woman officer.
What are they doing?
They're setting up a command center, Mrs. Capodora.
Beth stared at her. So you're worried?
We have to take the disappearance of a child this small after this length of time very, very seriously, Mrs. Capodora.
It was 4 p.m. Ben had been missing for 2 hours.
There were two cops at each of the exits Beth could see, and the slice of the circle drive that lay inside her vision was filling with blue and white cars, like a puzzle with pieces sliding into place. Jimmy Doherty crossed in front of the revolving door. Beth excused herself and wobbled thickly to his side. She asked Jimmy for a Marlboro. He lit it.
Bethy, Pat will be here soon.
Beth was startled. I didn't call him.
Jimmy ground out his own cigarette with a vicious twist of thumb and forefinger.
You didn't call Pat?
I thought we'd find him right away, and Pat had to work.
She sounded like the kind of light-witted ninny who'd soon begin to complain that she was missing her soap opera.
Jimmy touched her elbow. I'll call Pat now.
Pat wouldn't have left a 3-year-old to wander off alone. He would have made quick, fail-safe preparations, waved Ellen over, or quickly brought Vincent and Ben to Jill, who'd been ferrying bags up in the elevator. He would have given the 3 minutes that safety demanded, not waded off blunderingly the way Beth did, trying to cut corners, shave time, consolidate motions. The brown-haired bun officer was back.
Now, Mrs. Capodora, one thing that sometimes happens is parents sometimes have fingerprints taken of their children.
Beth shouted, "Fingerprints?" The lobby went still for a long instant. Then a phone rang, and a bubble of voices quietly resumed. And then Beth said,
"I did, actually. We had this school program Identikid through Dane County. We did all of them."
Beth thought the officer might literally jump up and down. "That's so wonderful, Mrs. Cappadora. Now we have a good tool, a real helper for finding Ben." Now Jimmy approached Beth with a willowy woman, ash blonde, with the kind of languid, manicured hands Beth associated with the Shorewood mothers for whom she sometimes shot garden festivals. The woman wore a short plaid skirt and a long cotton sweater. "He's going to introduce me to his wife," thought Beth. "Beth, this is my boss. This is Detective Supervisor Bliss." The woman smiled at Beth. "I'm not really his boss. Who could boss Jimmy? I just head up the detectives." Beth raised an eyebrow. "You're a police chief?" "No, just of detectives. My name is Candy Bliss." Beth laughed, snorted, she couldn't help it, and was instantly mortified. The woman's green eyes lighted with a kind of conspiratory joy. "I know, it sounds like a stripper, huh? My sister's name is Belle, can you beat that? Belle Bliss. I'm the stripper, she's the gun moll. The stuff parents can do to you, huh?" She stopped and pressed one slender finger against a deep line just between her arched brows. "I can't believe I said that. And Mrs. Cappadora, I want you to know we're going to find your little boy. Can we sit down?" Jimmy drifted away. Candy Bliss showed Beth a chair. "Now, here's the deal. Odds strongly favor finding Ben within the next hour. What we're seeing now, I think, is just that gap in time between someone finding Ben and bringing him to the police station or calling the police while they have Ben at their house." Beth sighed. "So you're saying you think he's no longer in the hotel, period?" "It's been a little too long for that now, Mrs. Cappadora, and this search has been pretty thorough." Beth reached for her glass and drained her drink. It was 5:30. Ben had been missing 3 hours and 30 minutes. Pat flew in the revolving glass door as if out of a hailstorm. It was 150 miles from the restaurant to Parkside, maybe more. Pat would later tell Beth he didn't really know how fast he drove, but she calculated it had to be close to 100 miles an hour. No one stopped him. He paid no tolls. He left the door of the freezer open and the lip of the cash register hanging out, the tray stuffed with money. The kitchen phone was off the hook, twisting on its rubber cord when the chef found it. Hastily, Beth stuck her half-full glass behind her and scrambled to her feet. Pat rushed at her, grabbed her, held the back of her skull in his free hand as if she were a child. "Bethy, tell me how this happened. Tell me where Ben is." Beth made a small motion. Should she shrug, try to speak, explain? Pat let her go, not entirely gently. Beth's mother-in-law, Rosie, came in the revolving door carrying the keys. She'd driven. Angelo would have wanted to, but he was older than she by 10 years, a little loose behind the wheel at the best of times. Rosie, who was boss, didn't trust him in a crisis. Rosie was little, light-boned, not at all the stereotypic black-shawled Sicilian mama. She had a page boy and wore a silver moon pin on her plum-colored jacket. She looked chic, thought Beth, and collected, as she patted Beth's cheek and murmured, "Carissima," and exchanged a look with Pat. No words necessary. Then, without asking for a progress report, Rosie assumed she'd get that if there were progress, she took the elevator upstairs to fetch Jill and Carrie. Angelo barreled in with a tray of cream horns for the police and set them down on the table where the phone bank burred steadily. Angelo and Rosie had never had a child mortally ill or a grandchild lost. They'd been married 40 years, and, for all Beth knew, their life's severest tragedy had been the death of Beth's own mother, their dearest friend. Even so, Beth could see they'd do the right thing. They'd help find Ben, and they'd forgive her. By contrast, Beth's father Bill was red-faced and dazed when he arrived. Not because of the crisis. He'd been golfing, with the firefighters. He'd been a chief through most of Beth's childhood, though he was retired now 10 years. Her father wasn't rising to the moment. It was his habit to act as if the world perplexed him. Beth was sure it didn't. It was only Bill's way of getting someone else to manage. Candy Bliss wanted a picture of Ben for distribution to the media. It was getting late now, and she didn't want to miss morning paper deadlines. Did Beth have a picture of Ben? Beth had dozens. She'd brought a score of them for purposes of bragging for the reunion. But she had no idea, she told Captain Bliss, where her purse was. Pat found it under the luggage trolley. It was wet, the contents half scattered. He held out a picture of Ben in his baseball shirt, grinning with his velcroed catch mitt held close to one cheek. Captain Bliss reached for the photograph, and Beth screamed, "Ben!" And then again, as the fragile crust of her muddled restraint cracked and then broke entirely, "Ben! Ben! Ben! Ben!" It got easier then. "Ben! Ben!" When Pat put his hand over her arm to try to ease her down, she leaned over and seized it in her teeth, biting hard. The room took on the aspect of a hospital emergency room, a sudden bustle. Pat and Jimmy tried to strong-arm Beth, but she tossed them off as they scrabbled to grab different parts of her. Candy Bliss turned to the manager. "Call a doctor." Beth looked at the clock. It was nearly midnight.
"Ben!"
A paramedic, very cute, slipped a blood pressure cuff around Beth's arm. And the doctor, who arrived minutes later in a jogging suit, squirted a golden liquid out of a syringe. The drops flicked down.
"We need to get you some rest here, Mrs. Cappadora."
He swabbed parts of her arms and hands with alcohol, whatever patches of skin he could reach as she flailed. He looked up at no one in particular.
"Listen, we need some help."
Nick charged across the room then, and half lay on top of Beth. He smelled wonderful, spicy. His chest was harder than Pat's, bigger. He held her left arm against her body, while the paramedic extended the right. The shot was painful, stinging, aching as it seeped in. Nick looked into her eyes.
"Bessie, I know, I know."
And then black wings brushed her face. Then they fell. When Beth awoke, she was tucked hard into a huge bed. Tucked so hard she was nearly straitjacketed. "Ben." Every available light in the room was on. Directly beside her, in a second king-sized bed, Pat was asleep on top of the bedspread. He was oblivious, snoring. Beth looked out into the corridor. It was absolutely hushed, dim-lighted. Faintly, from outside, she could hear the whump of beating helicopter blades. Down in the elevator, in the lobby, it was lighter, but still. Beth walked out into the night, which was balmy, Floridian, cleansed. Ben. A moonless night. Across from the hotel, Beth could see the blue roof lights of Immaculata. There was no traffic to dodge. Beth crossed the street, growing stronger on gulps of air. She walked through the courtyard, past the statue, past the marquee that read, "Welcome Home, Immaculata Class of 72. Out past the field house, the tennis courts, out to the field. Just before the gate to the bleachers, she crossed the red wooden bridge that spanned an estuary of Salt Creek. Beth stood over the stream, no more than half a foot deep, intent on seeing a clue. But she knew she needn't look for Ben here. Ben wouldn't go near water. When they'd visited Pat's aunt in Florida, Vincent ran into the waves. Pat had to chase him and explain the undertow. Ben wouldn't even walk on the damp sand. He looked at Beth solemnly. "There's too much water." She tried to coax him. "Ben, come in just a little. Mama will hold you." Ben, stolid in his neon pink trunks, pointed. "Is that the deep end?" His terror was like a scent on him. "I don't want to go in the deep end of the ocean. Sharks are there. Do I have to go?" "No, no, Benbo." Beth had scooped him up, unsure whether she should just stomp out there and dip him, get it over with. She didn't want her boy to grow up timid, shy of this, of that. "Don't be afraid. I'd be with you. Mama would never let the ocean snatch you away. I'd hold you tightest and tightest, wouldn't I?" Ben was buying time. "You know what, Mama? You can go to the deep end, but you can't come back." And Beth, relenting, chilled, sat with him all that long afternoon, high on the brow of the beach, scooping sand. Now, bracing herself on her hands, Beth climbed to the top deck of the bleachers. They were slippery with dew, tacky with chipped paint. She held her arms and shivered. Wind from the cloudy sky seemed to reach down for her, hunt, prod. Beth lay on the bleachers, stretching herself out to fullest length, and emptied herself of tears until her sweater was soaked and her forehead pulsed against the wood. When she looked up, not at a sound, but at something else, a disturbance of the air, Candy Bliss was standing at the foot of the bleachers. She held a plastic zip bag, small enough for a sandwich. In it was Ben's high-topped shoe, so clean and new, the red parrot still glowed in the dark. Finding the tennis shoe changed everything. It was the shoe that made Ben kidnapped. It proved, for Candy Bliss, that Ben hadn't wandered away on his own. She and Candy walked back through the dark behind the hotel. There was a kitchen door next to the stock bay. Candy Bliss led Beth there. The shoe, Candy explained, had been found on a low shelf in the newsstand, where toys on a rack hung in neon rainbow ranks. It was low enough that Ben could have put it there himself, but it was tied, neatly tied in a tight bow, in a way that most three-year-olds could never have done alone, and he couldn't have taken it off without untying it either. Candy examined the shoe. "It's not conclusive, Mrs. Capodoro, but it's enough to start on, and of course that's how we felt anyway." Beth sighed. "That someone abducted Ben?" Candy nodded. "It's just that whole lobby full of people, you know, hiding in plain sight." She shook her head. "Beth, now you're sure Ben couldn't tie?" "God, no, he could barely cut pancakes with a fork. He was three." She snagged her lip with her teeth. "He's three." Pat showed up then, his face blurred with sleep, his hand still seeping under the bandage from Beth's bite. And Candy sat down with both of them. After the state troopers assigned to the case arrived, there'd be mapped coverage areas for ground and air searches. There'd be computer searches, with the help of the list provided by the reunion planners. And the first individuals they'd concentrate on interviewing would be those with criminal histories. There were lists and interviews and the first Crime Stopper poster of Ben's face to approve. Beth, luckily, she thought, looked away at the last minute, so she never saw Ben's trusting eyes look back at her from black-and-white photocopy. When Beth began to dry heave in the sink, the doctor, whose name Beth never knew, showed up again and gave her sample packets of tranquilizers. But when she couldn't keep those down either, he gave her another shot, and she slept, hearing everything, even her brother Bick's voice. She tried to wake up to talk to Bick, but couldn't fight her way through the slumberous layers. At one point, Pat sat her up, and they watched grainy, early morning news video of teams of neighborhood volunteers and Immaculata classmates walking the forest preserve and the golf course shoulder to shoulder. When Ben's baseball cap picture flashed on the screen and a young woman said, "A community is mobilized to find little Ben," Beth screamed, and Pat turned the set off. On Monday afternoon, over Beth's objections, Pat insisted they leave the Tremont. "I have to tell you, Bethy, I think you'll get more of a grip if we go home to my mother's. You'll come around a little. Every minute we sit here, we're just looking at where it happened." When they got to Rosie and Angelo's, Ellen was there to drive Beth to the volunteer center in the basement of Immaculata's church hall. Beth looked at Ellen blankly. "What volunteer center?" "You know, Beth, leafleting and searches. This lady came yesterday morning from Crime Stoppers and taught us how to set it up. These first 36 hours are critical." There'd been 320 Immaculata graduates. And there must have been, Pat later said, 150 people in the church hall basement connected with the school alone. Even Cecil Lockhart had signed up to come, but then couldn't at the last minute because her mother had taken ill. Ellen smiled at Beth, but she sends her love, and I really believe she meant it. She's going to come and work when her mom gets better. You know, Beth, she has a little boy not much older than Ben, from her second marriage, or her third, or her fifth. I didn't even know that, but she sounded so sick over it. Everyone does, Bethy. Everyone. Just after Beth and Pat arrived, Laurie walked in, carrying a stack of three-ring binders. She looked as though she'd been in bed with flu and shouldn't have gotten up. Since college, Laurie had been Beth's best friend in Madison, she sometimes thought her only friend. Beth had once told Laurie she could win the Nobel Prize for Organization. She was in laureate form. Long tables, usually used to hold the food at parish teas and wedding breakfasts, were covered with phones and stacks of leaflets, posters on red and blue and yellow paper. Pat picked one up, and Beth read the bold print headline, "Have you seen Ben today?" over a thankfully unfamiliar picture of Ben that Ellen had taken last summer in her yard, and a phone number Laurie had commandeered for its unforgettability, 1-800-FIND-BEN. But after 10 days, even Laurie had to go home to her life, and the number of volunteers was dwindling. Beth loved the center, its smell of newly opened reams of medium-weight bond and stale coffee, with a near-romantic fervor. It and Candy's obsessively cluttered office on the second floor of the Parkside police station were the only places Beth felt sheared, however briefly, of Ben's loss, of the weight she sometimes felt would compress her into a flake of skin. No one in the locked offices at Parkside questioned Beth's presence anymore. They simply buzzed her in wordlessly. Though there was an elevator, Beth always took the stairs, and when she opened the steel door that would lead directly around a corner into Candy's open office, she heard an unfamiliar male voice. "Candace, I know how you feel about this, but this kid is dead. This kid is dead, and from his point of view, that's probably a good thing. And don't say I know it, because I don't know it," Beth heard the familiar sound of Candy tapping her eraser on her blotter. "It's just another..." The plainclothes cop, whom Beth had never seen before, turned and noticed her. "Ah, hi, Mrs. Capodora." Beth smiled as Candy looked up at her. "Beth, come in. See you later, McGuire." The detective left, and Candy looked evenly at Beth. "You heard, didn't you?" "It wasn't a question." Beth sat down without being asked and watched as an anxious-looking intern brought in the mail. Candy began to flip through it absently, finally coming to an oversized manila envelope, a bubble-lined book mailer stuffed nearly to bursting. She grinned at Beth. "Another one."
"You mean stuff from a confessor?"
They'd sent hand-drawn maps leading to non-existent addresses and abandoned buildings where they said Ben was being held. They'd sent articles of brand-new clothing they said were Ben's. She suspected there were other packages, sinister ones, that Candy never shared. Candy had told her, early on, that there were only three reasons someone would take a child: to get at that child's parent, economically or personally; to want a child and be crazy enough to think it was okay to take someone else's; or, in the very slimmest slice of a single percentage, to savage that child. Of the three, Candy told Beth, you hope for the crazy wannabe parent, because that person will care for the child tenderly. So, the package could contain anything: a bloody T-shirt, a pair of already threadbare denim shorts, slashed and stiff with... But Candy smiled. No, I mean stuff from Rebecca, my former buddy in the academy, who's now a stockbroker. See, she gains and loses about 30 pounds every 6 months or so. It's a very expensive habit, because as soon as she starts getting fat, she starts mailing all her thin clothes to me. Candy shook her head. The thing is, even when she looks good, Bex looks like the fortune teller at a street fair. Beth smiled. Sounds like a muffled cry for help to me. Candy held up the mailer. Actually, it's a padded cry for help. And Beth, to her horror, laughed, instantly covering her eyes and feeling that she was about to choke. Candy was on her feet and around the desk in seconds. Beth, listen, you laughed. You only laughed. If you laugh, it doesn't mean that's a point against our side. If you laugh or read a book to Vincent or eat something you like, it's not going to count for or against us on the big scoreboard of luck. Beth began to cry. You have to believe me, Beth. You're not going to kill your son because you laughed. Humiliated, even as she did it, Beth reached out and took Candy's hand, holding it against her cheek. Abruptly, Candy snatched her hand away, and Beth jumped up, nearly knocking over the chair. I didn't mean anything, Candy. I know, I'm such a jerk. There was absolutely nothing wrong with what you just did. I'm just an oversensitive jerk. Beth shrugged. You can't get involved. No, I mean, yes, to an extent. You can't get so involved you lose sight of things that could help people. But what that was about was, I'm a woman, I'm a detective supervisor, I'm Jewish, and I'm gay. Did you know that? Every possible kind of weirdness. So I feel like the eyes of Texas are upon me all the livelong day. I feel like every time I hug Katie Wright from Crime Stoppers, somebody thinks I'm making a pass at her. Beth shook her head. I wasn't trying. Candy motioned for Beth to stop. I know you weren't. Jesus, I'm a jerk. Candy sat down. But you know what? These bad clothes have given me a good idea. Let's go get a drink. I don't know why, cognac. Candy shoved the snifter at Beth as they sat at a table in the hotel bar. The hotel, a budget place with a chain restaurant attached, was the first they'd passed on the way from the station house. Beth took another drink. You look like Gloria Steinem. Beth wondered if she was getting drunk. So says everyone. Candy ordered herself a vodka and tonic. She looked up sharply. I'm not on duty, Beth. I just want you to know. I wouldn't have a drink if I was on duty. I mean, I'm not on duty any more than I'm ever not on duty. I come in on almost all my days off. Beth frowned. Why? Very tedious personal life. Come on, Candy. No, Beth, I really do have not much of a life. It's not uncommon for female cops. Beth took a sip of cognac. Don't you have a partner? Not now. Candy brushed her forehead. Beth didn't know what to say next. Was she being too personal? Is there a lot of... Beth paused, gulped, and went on. A lot of prejudice against you in the department? Not as much as in my own family. Candy smiled broadly. No, not anymore. You can't be overt about that stuff much anymore. But when I was a kid and I started, you had to be really sure nobody ever knew. I mean, nobody. It was in a gay bar that someone had passed Candy, who was then working as a research assistant for a lawyer, a want ad for Tampa City police matrons, and dared her to apply. She applied and got the job. Candy sighed. They regretted it, though, because after a couple of years I started noticing guys I'd trained advancing through the ranks, getting paid twice what I was, and I sued and I won. I won my gun. Candy motioned for another drink, and as she did, her eyes narrowed and locked on a space just over Beth's shoulder. Beth, will you excuse me for a minute? Beth turned her head. She didn't recognize the officer, but he wore a state trooper's ample felt hat and kept his arms folded in front of him the entire time he talked to Candy, towering over her, looking down at her as if she were a child. Only his head moved, gesturing repeatedly to the right, as if he were pointing outside the window to his sleek black-and-silver squad. Candy looked back at the table, and Beth thought instantly, she's sober. She's sober. And that means this has to do with something big, awful, with me. Beth took one step, wavered, and Candy came striding over to her and took hold with a vice-clamp grip under Beth's armpit. They walked out into the parking lot, dazzled with the late afternoon sun. Beth, you're right, I know you're scared, But this isn't necessarily anything either. We have to know. That's all we have to know. Beth gasped.
What? What?
We've found a body. It's a child, and it's a boy. But that's all we know, Beth. That's absolutely all we know. Beth had stood outside a great many morgue doors, some at hospitals, some at prisons, some at disaster sites, photographing stretchers with their cased black plastic burdens. But she'd never been inside one. It looked like a school corridor, with frosted glass windows and blonde doors. Candy led the marching V of officers surrounding Beth, Pat, Ellen, and Bick as they walked to an elevator. This is what Cook County defines as a waiting room. Candy pointed to a shaky collection of green leather sofas and chairs, some spouting stuffing. I'm going to take Bick upstairs. What he's going to see is a view of the child's face and pertinent, well, through glass. If he has any questions, we'll come back for Ellen.
Ellen? Thought Beth. Ellen?
Ellen nodded, putting her finger to her lips. Everyone slumped back against the green leather seats. There was to be a wait, then. Beth felt like a hostess, like she should be offering everyone something to drink. No one spoke. A minute by the huge clock on the wall. What would a regular woman say? Beth asked herself. A regular woman would ask about her children. Eleni, who's taking care of... She didn't get to finish, because Bick came lurching out of the stairwell, his arm over his eyes, the click of Candy's heels close behind him, and then she, too, out the door. Wait, Beth thought. We were supposed to get a wait. Bick fell down on the sofa next to her, hunched over, tears pouring.
Bethy, Bethy, it's not Ben. Wait.
Beth tried to lift one of her arms, her impossibly waterlogged and heavy arms like logs. Are you sure? Pat was on his knees in front of Bick, searching his face.
He's way too small. And his hair. It's red hair, but it's like strawberry blonde. He's really a baby, Bethy. Oh, he's somebody's baby, Bethy. His little face was like he was asleep. He wasn't even wrecked. Not his face. Oh, Bethy, it's not Ben.
Pat took a deep breath. Oh, thank you, God. It's not him. It's not him. It's not Ben. Pat stopped, looking hard at Beth.
Beth, aren't you glad?
Beth looked blankly at Pat.
Glad?
One night, when Beth was hanging around Candy's office late, Candy had seemed to notice Beth afresh as she stood up around 7 to turn out her office light. You want some dinner, Beth? They took hot dogs from Mickey's and drove all the way down to the Lincoln Park lagoons, out to the grassy edge of the ponds. A dozen or so black boys, each sleeker and more beautiful than the one before, threw handfuls of illegal fireworks across the water at one another. The air around them throbbed with old Motown tunes from the open windows of their cars. Beth and Candy sat down on the dry grass. Beth picked up her hot dog.
Everyone thinks I should go home.
What do you think? Candy was halfway through her own bag of fries and eyeballing Beth's. Beth nudged it toward her.
I think they have a point, Candy. I don't want to, though.
Beth, do you think, if you leave, we won't find Ben?
Maybe. I don't think you'll find Ben anyhow. Not really. I just don't...
Beth leaned back and lay on the grass. How impossibly winsome and sweet, a starry summer night. The kind of night that once invited something, a clean run, lovemaking, rocking a baby on the porch.
I don't think I can go back and start up life as if none of this ever happened.
You have these two great kids, Bethy. I give my right arm to have a kid like Carrie.
People do it, Candy. People, like you, do it all the time.
No, not people like me,
Gay women, yes, but not people like me. I mean, I could. But, Beth, you don't become a cop because you're a rebel. I'm a deeply conventional person, Beth. I know that sounds crazy, given my... Well, just leave it at that. I always thought I'd have a husband and kids. I just could never see the husband. Candy paused to stuff her mouth with a fistful of fries. There's this guy. We're old buddies. He was my law professor. I went to a year of law school during my Watergate period. He had a crush on me, a bad crush, and I had to tell him I didn't do men, that is, anymore. Which is to say, I have in my life, though I can't imagine why I'm telling you that. Jesus. Anyhow, Chris and I, we hang out. We get Chinese maybe once a month, watch Spencer Tracy movies. Chris is probably 47 or something now, and he's this perennial bachelor. Dates young women, co-eds. I have sweaters older. And then, of course, me. We go to the ballet and stuff. Do his big firm gala things. I tell him, Chris, I'm your beard. You know what that means, Beth? Beth nodded. She didn't. I'm like his surrogate wife for places he can't take the young chickies. Candy lay back on her elbows, Beth wincing over the contact of the grass with the fine beige linen. A few Christmases ago, I had this party. I told you I'm a bad Jew. And he brought this girl. Beth, I don't think she could drive yet. And I told him, Chris, you're going to be hanging around the middle school soon. This is getting fairly despicable. And he looked at me so sadly. What he said was, I'm tired, Candy. I want a son. I would marry you, Candy. You name the day. Candy smiled slowly. Shit, can you please point out why I'm telling you all this? The teenagers were drifting back to their car. The air smelled of cordite from the last wisps of firework smoke. I don't mind, Beth smiled, thinking that was lame. I'm glad you did. And one more thing, Candy wadded up the paper wrappings. If you go home, it doesn't mean I'll forget you or stop working to find Ben. I'll work every day, Bethy, as long as it takes. And if you want to call me every day and make sure I'm working, you can. And I'll call you, too, all the time, I promise. So 3 weeks later, when Pat came with the baby on Saturday night, Beth had told him she'd be going home with him on Sunday. At first, it was just bed. Beth acted as if she had one of the long, sheet-sweating diseases of childhood. She had her huge, delightfully full bottle of little blue footballs left over from the doctor in Chicago, and two of them sent her into a dreamless torpor for 6 hours at a time. When Pat came home from the restaurant before the night rush, she made sure to get up and hold the baby on her lap and look at Vincent. Then she handed the baby back to Jill and went back to bed. The children had seen her. They knew she was alive. Soon she began to notice that she smelled. Her underwear was crusty. Her oily head felt as though it were crawling with lice. So she showered, put on clean underwear and a t-shirt, and got back into bed, virtuous. If she went on like this indefinitely, would the children be able to say they'd never had a mother? Of course not. They'd be able to say they had a mother and she was home all the time, a stay-at-home mom, which Beth had never been. And then Beth did get up most mornings. The signal often was a phone call from Candy or Lori or Rosie. There was another body to identify. Bick had done the duty. The boy in Gary, Indiana, was at least 7. Another call. Did she know that there was now a billboard of Ben's face on I-90, right near the huge shopping center? Yes, Beth would reply. Yes to everything, sure. And then she'd get up and brush her teeth. She might spend the whole day curled in the corner of the couch, furtively watching the street. But she did get up. When Candy showed up on the porch early one afternoon, Beth had had a good morning. She'd showered and fed Carrie her cereal on her own. She let Candy come in, returned her hug, and felt puzzled by the way Candy held her at arm's length and looked her over top to bottom. Beth, what you're wearing is very strange.
Beth was, in fact, wearing ordinary wool pants. They were pants from the 70s, which she discovered not long ago during a closet raid. She had no idea how much weight she'd lost, but on impulse, she'd tried on these pre-childbearing pants, with their wide legs and eccentric wraparound belts, and found that they nearly fit. There had been perhaps 5 pairs, which Beth now wore regularly, either with one of her sweatshirts or one of Pat's shirts. Beth tied the shirt tails around the front of the pants. She was covered from top to bottom, and wouldn't have to be embarrassed to be discovered in her robe if anyone showed up. "I've lost a lot of weight," Beth shrugged. "And these are just fine for working around the house."
"But Beth, what about for working?"
"I'm, retired. I can't imagine. You know, I took pictures of news things and people and weddings and stuff, Candy. I couldn't do that now. I don't think I could take pictures of food, even."
Candy crossed her arms. "But you might want to, you know, sometime, don't you think? I mean, didn't you always work?"
Beth nodded. "Beth, do you have any money in the house? I thought we could go shopping."
Beth started to laugh.
"Candy, I don't go shopping. What would I go shopping for?"
"Some clothes, maybe. If you haven't got any money, have you got a MasterCard or something?"
"It's in the envelope, taped to the fridge. They probably won't recognize my signature, though. They only know Jill's. She's Beth Capodora now."
Candy palmed the card. "Not today. Do you want to put on something? Well, it doesn't matter. Come on, Beth, let's go."
"I don't know, Candy." Beth was trying to sound just a little bored, restless. "It's so crowded in these joints."
"We'll only go to one store. I just don't know what one store, so bear with me."
They ended up at a place called Cotton to Cotton. After 40 minutes, Candy had filled 4 shopping bags, and Beth had surrendered her card.
On the way home, she told Beth, "Now, the deal is, you can wear any one of those things with any other one of those things. So if one is dirty, just pull out another one and put it on. They all go together, even the belts. And you can wear black shoes with every single thing, flats or heels. You do have black shoes, don't you?"
"Yes," Beth nodded. The clothes still had the tags on them 2 months later. The night Laurie showed up, when Pat was just about